You're listening to Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the Brothers Anderson talk about movies. We don't merely scratch the surface, we dig deep and probe the movies. We get up all in there, but not in a creepy way. Spoilers, there will be some. Sit back, grab a beverage of your choice, close your eyes and listen to the sounds of the Brothers Anderson.
Awkward.
Welcome, this is Eric.
This is Brother Jay.
And tonight, the movie is The Talented Mr. Ripley, 1999, based on a 1955 novel by Patricia Highsmith.
I was gonna ask if this was based on a novel because of how it was set.
Do you know anything about Miss Patricia Highsmith?
I do not.
Okay, well, according to her biographer, Andrew Wilson, her personal life was a troubled one. She was an alcoholic who never had an intimate relationship that lasted more than a few years. She was seen by some of her contemporaries and acquaintances as misanthropic and cruel. She famously preferred the company of animals to that of people, and once said, "My imagination functions much better when I don't have to speak to people."
I like her already.
Well, hold on, it gets better. She also loved cats.
Oh.
She bred about 300 snails in her garden at her home in Suffolk, England. She once attended a London cocktail party with a gigantic handbag that contained a head of lettuce and 100 snails, who she said were her companions for the evening.
Oh dear.
Her acquaintance Otto Penzler was quoted as saying, "She was a mean, hard, cruel, unlovable, unloving person. I could never penetrate how any human being could be that relentlessly ugly."
Wow.
Yeah, so people had opinions about Miss Highsmith.
Clearly.
Yeah.
That is, you have to work at that.
Exactly, yeah. She wasn't just an oddball. She seemed to have a very specific point of view.
Wow, okay.
Yeah. So now, that doesn't necessarily change my opinion at all about the movie, because I think the movie is a beautiful movie.
Well, and I watched the credits, and I was impressed, because, I mean, this was shot on location, many locations, and, you know, and it's visually a gorgeous film. It's got great vistas in the countryside and the shots of the sea. I mean, it is really just visually a stunning movie.
And the score is also fantastic.
I agree.
I mean, it's a rich movie. It's a rich looking movie.
Yeah, but after a while, the jazz got on my nerves. But
well, yeah, I think that's more of a personal preference, I think.
Yeah, well, also because the jazz is gimmicky, so.
True. Absolutely true. So we have a character, by the way, that this is one of four movies about Tom Ripley.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Did you know that there's also a movie called Ripley's Game that stars as a slightly older Tom Ripley, John Malkovich?
That's creepy just hearing it.
And there's another Ripley movie called Ripley Underground in 2005, where Barry Pepper plays Thomas Ripley.
So ostensibly, so this is like, so since he was, I assume these were all novels then.
Yes.
So the end of this movie wasn't the end of him then, clearly.
Oh, not at all.
Okay.
No, it's actually, one could probably say that the end of this movie was the beginning. But let's get into it. We have a young sociopath named Tom Ripley. Or is he a sociopath?
So here's where the beginning of the movie lost me. Because in the very, very beginning of the movie, it's him with jazz records, trying to figure out jazz.
Yes.
But that's before he got hired.
Nope, it's after he got hired.
So this was kind of a flashbacky movie. Because he wasn't hired in the beginning.
Well, no, he was the piano player at a cocktail party.
But he was learning the jazz records in the opening of the film.
I don't remember it that way. Okay. I'm pretty sure devoted himself to jazz once he found out that Dickie Greenleaf was a jazz fanatic. Because he actually didn't even like jazz necessarily.
Well, if you say so. That's not what I wrote, but maybe I'm...
Oh, no. I mean, I could be wrong, too.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, it's just that... Okay, so it starts with, we have Thomas Ripley, or Tom Ripley, who is Matt Damon. By the way, do you want to take a stab at who else was in the running, or who was considered for the role?
Well, I don't even. It was 99, so it would be hard to know. Because it would have to have been a younger guy. So Leonardo DiCaprio?
Yep, absolutely. Christian Bale?
No? Yeah, I can see that.
And the director originally wanted Tom Cruise to play Ripley. But after seeing Good Will Hunting, he cast Matt Damon.
Matt Damon! I thought this was a good choice, although I could see Leonardo DiCaprio doing this is a good role. Although, I don't know. Matt Damon played the nervous Nelly pretty well.
Yeah, I thought he did an excellent job in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, everybody in this movie did a great job, with the possible exception for Miss Paltrow, who did fine, but she wasn't great.
Well, as is typical with her, and I like her, I don't dislike her, but as is typical with some of her roles, this was really overacted, in my opinion, from her. It would have done with a little bit of subtlety.
But the rest of the movie has got some fun stuff. Anyway, so who we have is Tom Ripley, who we see at first, he's a piano player at this cocktail party, and he's wearing a Princeton jacket. And he's then approached by a wealthy shipbuilder, Herbert Greenleaf, who's played by James Rebhorn. And James Rebhorn is great in anything.
Just recently passed away.
Did he? Yeah. But still, great. So, Herbert Greenleaf, seeing the Princeton jacket, assumes that Tom went to school with his son, Dickie. Dickie Greenleaf is played by Jude Law. And he was actually nominated for an Academy Award for this role and won a BAFTA Award for it.
Wow.
So, Herbert Greenleaf, he's upset that his son Dickie has gone off to Europe and is squandering his future. So, he recruits Ripley to travel to Italy and persuade Dickie to return home. And he's going to pay Ripley $1,000 to do it. Now, Ripley agrees to do this. And then we find out that he not only just borrowed the jacket, or he's replacing somebody else as the piano player, but of course he never went to Princeton. He doesn't know Dickie Greenleaf. But what he is a big fat liar. And he's good at lying, impersonations, and forgery. So he decides to go to Europe on Mr. Greenleaf's dime and hunt for Dickie. Now, when he takes the ship over to Europe, he encounters another American who is a wealthy American, and this is a movie about class as much as it is about anything else.
Because this movie's about the 1%.
Yeah, because Cate Blanchett, a young Cate Blanchett, I thought did a really good job hamming it up as a super wealthy, embarrassed about being so wealthy person, who sort of falls in love with Tom Ripley, who she believes, by the way, he gives his name to her as Dickie Greenleaf. Are we all together?
I don't care for her much.
For the Cate Blanchett character or for her herself? The actress?
For her in general.
Oh.
The actress in general. I don't know. I was just skimming through her IMDb, and I'm like, I don't think I've seen her in much of anything. So, anyway.
Well, she was good in the Elizabeth movies.
The Elizabeth movies?
Yeah, she played Queen Elizabeth the First.
Oh, that's probably where I saw her. I saw the first, I saw Elizabeth, and I don't think I saw, what year did that come out? 1998, okay. So I did see that then, and I really liked Elizabeth, so I guess I didn't realize it was her. But her character was okay. I kind of got, I don't know, there's something, I guess I had it was a hard time because I guess this was set in the 50s, and so it was very kind of, it was a different time. And anyway, she wasn't terrible.
So then Ripley finds Dickie and his fiancée, Marge Sherwood, the lovely and talented Gwyneth Paltrow, and pretty much arranges for an accidental meeting, a reunion of sorts, where he introduces himself as a fellow classmate and just insinuates himself into their life.
And by the way, this is at the point where this is one of my first notes. Before they made the joke, I'm like, oh my God, he is painfully white.
Oh yeah. But
he's
lost,
like, embarrassingly, like, painfully, like, he's like me white. He's so white.
Well, he lost 30 pounds for the role because he is ripped too.
Yeah, no, I made a later note in the movie. This is what my note is. He sure shows off the six pack a lot.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then I also wrote, this is really beautifully shot. And then, accidental meeting, and then at the shortly thereafter where he starts out the creepy, where he's, and I wrote OMG, creepy voices in the mirror.
Yes, exactly.
I was like, that actually raised all the hair on the back of my, I was like, that is creepy. And then I wrote, it's odd how he's just accepted as the third wheel. He's just instantly picking in.
Well, and that's the thing. It's because all of the characters have tension about that. Because he just keeps showing up and they don't quite know what to do with him. In fact, Dickie and Marge are kind of giving themselves a side eye, even from the very beginning, about who this guy is.
Except Dickie really likes him and really wants him around and encourages him to be around.
Well, partly because Ripley gives Dickie all of these little clues into things that he professes to be interested in that really are things that Dickie's passionate about, like jazz.
Yeah.
Like he drops all these jazz references that he has studied so he can impress Dickie. And he can pull it off, which is, you know, the hard part of it. So Dickie takes him in, and much to Marge's dismay, even from the beginning, because he takes Ripley over to jazz clubs, and they're making plans to go skiing in the wintertime. And from the very beginning, Ripley tells Dickie why he's there.
Everybody should have one talent. What's yours?
Forging signatures. Telling lies. Impersonating practically anybody.
That's three. Nobody should have more than one talent.
Okay.
Do an impression.
Now? Huh. The only talent my son has is for cashing his allowance.
What?
Oh, I like to sail. Believe me, I love to sail. Instead, I make boats.
Stop!
Other people sail them.
It's too much. You're making all the hairs on my neck stand up.
Oh, yes, jazz. Oh, jazz. Let's face it. It's just insolent noise.
I feel like he's here. Horrible, like the old bastard's here right now.
Good.
That's brilliant. Brilliant! How do you know him?
I met him in New York.
Marge, yes. This is scary. You've got to hear this. Meet my father, Herbert Richard Greenleaf I.
Pleasure to meet you. Dickie's made a fine catch.
Uncanny.
I know Emily thinks so.
I don't get it.
It's uncanny.
Could you ever conceive of going to Italy, Tom, and bringing him back?
What?
I'd pay you if you would go to Italy, persuade my son to come home. I'd pay you $1,000.
So they decide together to spend a little of Dickie's dad's money with no intention of Dickie ever going back home.
As if the son wasn't already milking the trust fund enough.
Exactly. Yeah, Dickie is not a good guy either, really. I mean,
no, he's a spoiled brat.
Exactly. He's a spoiled brat. Exactly. He's a jackass, and you're not supposed to like him. He is rich, and he doesn't care about little people, and he doesn't want to. He just wants to have fun.
Yeah, I don't think I liked him at any point in the movie.
Nope, he's not. I don't think he's a character you're supposed to really like.
No, I disliked him from almost the get-go. And I liked Jude Law, and I liked him as an actor, so it was hard in a role not to like him.
Oh, I agree. Jude Law, even though once I saw him in this movie, it was hard to see any other movie without seeing him in this. He is a great actor. He really is.
Because he and Jude Law and Ethan Hawke were in Gattaca.
Yes, which I have never seen.
Oh, really? It's a fantastic movie.
Yeah, it's been recommended to me, but I've never seen it.
Oh, it's fantastic. Ethan Hawke would have been a good Mr. Ripley, by the way.
Yeah, that's an idea.
And it's Ethan Hawke and Uma Thurman.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not a... Except for Henry and June, I'm not much of a Uma Thurman fan.
Well, I don't go out of my way to watch Uma Thurman movies, but I liked her. She was a good role. It was a good role. Gattaca was, I really enjoyed Gattaca, so.
Yeah. Well, perhaps we'll have to watch it one day. Or
yeah,
talk about
but
it.
But as I said, I think we'd like, oh, we should have done Capote would have been the smart thing to do.
Oh, we can still do Capote. I own that too.
No, I'm just saying, I mean, after last week and Murder by Death and Capote, it would have been apropos.
Oh, yeah.
To do Capote, and then, of course, the whole James Garner death, which, you know, little bit sad.
Oh, very sad.
But digress. So, yeah. Jude Law. Yeah, no, you know, I didn't like him at all. And I didn't even try to like him. And
well, at first, you know, I think we're all supposed to root for Ripley. Because, you know, Ripley is just pretending to be one of these people. And, you know, since most of us aren't one of these people, you know, you can kind of put yourself in Ripley's shoes, at least in the beginning. Where, wow, it would be kind of cool to fake it and get into this community.
Yeah. But, 6 degrees of separation style.
Well, yeah, exactly. Yes. It's another good movie.
Very good movie, yes.
Anyway, Dickie and Ripley are palling around, and that's all fine. And then we meet another of Dickie's good friends, Freddie Miles.
The late, great Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Absolutely. And he is full on Seymour Hoffmaning it all up. He's great.
He's Hoffmaning everywhere. Is that what you said?
Yeah. Well, something like that. Yeah.
And so this is the confusing part with me, because this movie had a lot of like homoerotic tension. So ostensibly, I can't tell if Jude Law is a big mo.
I think you're supposed to believe eventually that he's not. But in the beginning, you think maybe it might be headed that way.
Well, and in the beginning, I kind of thought maybe his sexuality was kind of elastic.
Yeah, exactly.
Because then with the Freddy character, it almost seemed like there was, you know, there was something there, too. It was really kind of confusing. And maybe it was written that way just to add kind of dramatic tension in the movie, but or the book is probably, it was more likely. But it was hard to know who was attracted to who, because it seemed to me that, you know, if you're shacked up with your honey and some dude shows up, I don't know that you're going to disrupt that a whole lot.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. I mean, if your honey doesn't like jazz and it gets you down to the clubs, plus you're not completely faithful to your honey because you have a little bit on the side in Italy anyway.
Well, apparently a lot on the side. So
yeah. Yeah, because he impregnates a local girl who then drowns herself.
Well, and did she really drown herself?
I think so, yeah.
So she drowned herself and nobody killed her.
No, I don't think anybody killed her.
I think Ripley killed her.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that is possible because he certainly jumps on it. I mean, he immediately, when her body washes ashore and everybody's all upset, of course, because it's a body who washes ashore. Yeah. Jude Law is really freaking out because he knows this person and he knew she was pregnant.
Yeah.
And he'd already told her, you know, we're not going to do this.
And I have to say, though, at this point in the movie, the floating Madonna out of the water thing was like one of the creepiest things I've ever witnessed.
Wasn't it? I mean, again, another beautifully shot scene.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know it has some kind of religion. I mean, you know, the Italian Catholics are obviously, you know, the original Catholics, probably the Pope and all. But I'm sorry. This is it's like the creepy alien woman coming out of the water.
Yeah. Well, again, with these some of these church ceremonies are mystical and difficult for the outsider to comprehend.
And I didn't. So yeah. I was just like, wow, that's creepy.
But Drew and I are talking about the movie Stigmata later today.
Oh.
Have you seen that movie?
No. Oh, do you seriously? It sounds like a movie I would watch.
Well, no, I know. It's Gabriel Byrne, though, and Patricia Arquette.
Oh, well, that's disappointing. I like both of them.
Well, no, anyway. Well, you'll hear the podcast. It turns out it's a little bit Nightbreed, except that I absolutely love the opening song in the movie.
No.
Anyway, we'll get there on the next podcast. So all tune right, in, people. Anyway, so we meet Freddie Miles, who pretty much sees through Ripley. He doesn't really see exactly what Ripley's up to, but he knows Ripley's up to no good. That he's just a hanger-on, you know, kind of a beggar at the feast.
He sees the desperation behind Ripley's cool, calm facade.
Especially since when Freddie shows up, he is really close to Dickie. So that closeness really threatens Ripley, who is becoming close to Dickie in his own right.
Yeah, Freddie occupies a spot that Ripley would like to be in.
Exactly. So after the girl dies, Ripley basically tells Dickie that he'll keep the secret to his grave that, you know, now they're like brothers and all this stuff. So that creeps Dickie right out. Although, is it before or after the drowning where there's the playing chess in the bathtub scene?
I think the chess scene was after.
Yeah, I think so too. Because that is a difficult scene. I mean, it was shot beautifully, but, you know, it's a painful scene to watch because it's weird. Anyway, would you play chess with anybody naked in the bathtub? I mean, they are naked in the bathtub and you are not?
Never.
Yeah, never, ever.
Not even if it was somebody I was romantically attached to.
Yeah, same sex, opposite sex, wouldn't matter.
No. I mean, we had a hot tub, and we would hang out in the hot tub naked, you know, even with friends and stuff. But you know, we were all in the hot tub. One of us wasn't out of the hot tub. And of course, the nice thing about the hot tub is you can't see anything because the water's all bubbly. But no, I wouldn't be in still water where people could stare at my bits.
Yeah, or just like, actually, the whole idea. I mean, I like baths just like the next guy, but, and I can totally see, like, when we watched, or I watched the movie Laura. One of the characters in the movie Laura is a journalist or a columnist, and he writes his columns he's in a bathtub, and he's got this, like, it's a, like an inset marble kind of bathtub. And he's got this marble shelf that goes off in front of him, and he's got a typewriter on it, one of the old-fashioned typewriters. Mm-hmm. Black and white movie. So he's in the bath, like, doing his work like he's at a desk, which I thought was a little strange. But not any more strange than playing chess with somebody while you're naked in a tub.
Yeah, no, I couldn't do that.
Yeah, so there could be a reason why Ripley feels comfortable throwing the moves at him.
Which is why I thought that you know, because no normal, and I, you know, being a big homo myself, I'm like, there's very few instances where some straight dude is going to be in a bathtub next to you. It just doesn't, it's not going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, again, yeah, I've never, not to me, certainly, but.
I mean, you know, so that's why I was like, no, I think there was, like I said, I think Mr. Greenleaf, Dickie Greenleaf Jr., whoever he is.
Yeah, Dickie.
I think his sexuality was fairly elastic, and he just wasn't quite, the movie just didn't go into it. I would be interested to see what the novel actually had to say. But
well, here's a fun game to play. Are you familiar with the game Gay or British? Okay, if you're not, then that's a fun game, but I'm going to make it a little different. This is a game. This is a game we can call "Gay" or "New England Hoi Polloi."
Okay.
Because yeah. I mean, have you heard any of the Spalding Gray? I know I forced you to listen to some Spalding Gray.
I have ejected most of the Spalding Gray from my head just because of you.
But Spalding Gray, you could totally say, "Huh, New England or gay?" Because there's mannerisms and ways of speaking. Like, Freddie Miles could be, you know, gay as Christmas. Yeah. Or just a rich New England kid.
Yeah.
So, it's, especially in the 50s.
I have three words, Stephen Jesse Bernstein.
Exactly. Well, his game would be gay or zombie.
Yeah, the whole dead thing.
Yeah. So. Well, he was... If you've seen videos of Stephen Jesse Bernstein, which I actually recommend against, this guy is hard to look at as well as hard to listen to.
Imagine that.
As much as I love it, I wouldn't want to spend any time with Mr. Bernstein.
Well, or, especially because he's dead.
Yeah, well, or Mr. Miles or Mr. Greenleaf, either. Yeah, I mean, sadly, I think the Marge Sherwood Gwyneth Paltrow character is about the only one of the band that you would even like want to have any association with. Like, if you saw her in the grocery store, you wouldn't run away.
I think she was the most grounded of them all. But that's also not saying much considering the circle of people.
Yeah, well...
I wrote down at some point, it must have been much later in the movie, my notes were kind of all over the place. Because I take notes old school. I have a notebook... So pen and paper, but I couldn't find my notebook, and I'm really OCD, so I'm like, I can't just get a new notebook because I haven't finished the last notebook. So I took notes on my phone, and I'm never doing that again. So my notes are all kind of discombobulated. But I wrote down, this must have been much later in the film, but I wrote down, apparently in Italy you can kill people constantly.
There's that. Because...
Spoiler alert.
We're now, what, halfway through the movie?
Yeah.
And Dickie is pretty much done with Ripley. It's like, you know, he's already acting weird, and once he throws the moves on him and he's rejected in the bathtub chess scene, it's like, okay, time to move it along there. We've had our fun, and, you know, Dad isn't going for the, I need just a couple more months and some more money to help persuade Dickie to come home. So Dickie's like, okay, we got to cut Thomas loose. So he takes Tom out on a little sailing trip to kind of break the news to him.
Yeah.
Well, Ripley doesn't take this news well.
No.
No. So he keels Dickie in a rather brutal fashion.
Well, and I think that, you know, there was a lot of tension in that. And, you know, Jude Law was, Dickie was very mean-spirited in the whole taking him out of the boat and scaring him and doing it on purpose.
Like I said, up to this point, I think you feel sorry, or I felt sorry for Ripley, because now not only can he measure up to these people and he's just, you know, again, an imposter, but now he finds he has serious feelings for this guy and he's totally rejected.
Yeah.
And he has this constant, like, sad puppy look during the whole show, which is why I question whether or not he's a sociopath, because I don't think so.
I mean, you think he was just love torn?
Well, I think that, I mean, he does all these things that are horrible, but I think as portrayed in the movie, he feels bad about them.
He does.
Yeah. I mean, much more so than the John Malkovich movie.
I haven't seen it.
Yeah. If I remember correctly, the John Malkovich movie, he's more of a sociopath.
Oh.
And maybe in the book, he's more of a sociopath. I don't know.
But yeah, no, the boat scene was just creepy, you know, because spoilers, you know, he kills him in the boat, and then, you know, there's the blood and water sloshing around in the boat when he's laying with him in the boat. I was like, ugh.
Yeah, he kills them, and then he curls up next to the body and weeps.
It was so uncomfortable. Just like, ah.
By the way, during the boat scene, Jude Law broke a rib while filming because he fell backwards during the whole thing.
Yeah, he fell backwards and like hit the boat.
Something. Yeah.
Oh.
So it's what you get for your art. You suffer.
Boy, he was dead at that point. He wasn't showing up again in the movie.
Oh, no. So Dickie's dead. Yeah. So Ripley then goes back, and the hotel concierge mistakes him for Dickie. And that's like, ooh, lights are on. Except that you kind of got the impression, because at the very beginning, he's been forging Dickie's signature.
Yeah.
I mean, he's made no bones about the fact that he can make himself look and act like somebody else.
Yeah, he's got the talent of a mimic.
So he decides to cover up the death, but he sunk the boat and the body, and then he covers up the death by playing the parts of both Ripley and Dickie, and leaving phone messages and sending telegrams and letters from one to the other.
Which you could get away with in the 50s.
Yeah, and he uses, because Dickie, it is established early, doesn't, he always uses a typewriter. He doesn't handwrite anything. So he uses Dickie's typewriter to communicate with Marge.
Which was a convenient gimmick in the novel, I'm sure.
I'm sure. And he basically makes Marge believe that Dickie has deserted her, even though they had discussed getting married. And this was part of getting, cutting loose Ripley was also moving on and becoming an adult and marrying Marge, who he professed in the beginning he would never do. He would never get tied down.
Yeah.
So now he's rented an expensive apartment in Rome, and he spends Christmas buying presents for himself. But then his very, very elegant, upscale lifestyle is interrupted when Freddy visits, expecting to find Dickie, and instead finds Ripley in Dickie's apartment, The apartment is rented to Dickie, of course, under false pretenses. And then there's another kind of brutal scene where Ripley murders Freddy.
Yeah, and I wrote a note on this, but first I want to say every time you say Dickie, I think of Murder by Death, just FYI.
Oh, yeah.
But I wrote down at this point, after Ripley has killed Freddy, I see, gee, subtle with the head wound and the blood, because, you know, Freddy had a head wound, and it was bloody, and then, of course, the statue head, which the marble bust which he used, was bloody, which is the same kind of bloody head wound that he gave Dickie on the boat.
Yes, and also there's another thing about that marble bust.
Mm-hmm.
I think, I don't know, it's not in my notes, but I think the marble bust is a bust of somebody who was killed by a male lover. Something like that. Yeah, anyway.
But I wrote, gee, subtle with the head wound and blood, no scissors?
Exactly. So now we get to the point where, okay, we've stopped feeling, at least I've stopped feeling sorry for Ripley.
Oh, yeah.
But you realize that his charade can't go on forever, because now
he's basically running forward to keep from falling.
Exactly, yeah. He is lie upon lie upon lie, which, by the way, people, is why you shouldn't lie, because it's hard work. So, but everybody has to find that out sometime in their life. Ripley just finds it out on a more grand level than the rest of us. So anyway.
On a murder spree.
Yeah, well, yeah. So now once you kill everybody that's found you out, you're good to go. And this part, maybe you can explain to me a little bit. Because, okay, we've got some people who are still a problem for Ripley. We've got Marge, who now is convinced that, because, by the way, Ripley decides he needs to clear himself from the murder because, what, did they find his body, maybe, or?
Well, he drove Freddy off of the little cliff thingy or whatever.
But he also invents a suicide for Dickie.
Right.
And, of course, Marge cannot accept Dickie's death and says that Ripley must be involved.
Right.
Yeah, so she's pestering around, and we have, you know, of course, yeah, the death of Freddy, and the police kind of get involved in talking to him about that. But what's the deal with Mr. Greenleaf and Dickie's death? Because Greenleaf basically pays Ripley off not to discuss.
Well, because there was the reason that the dad sent Dickie to overseas to begin with is because they had to pay off the kid that he almost killed in college.
Oh, okay. They're excellent. Okay. Yeah. Now.
So because of all the violent past, they thought it was just better to keep Dickie, because Dickie was unpredictable and had a bad temper and got violent and was prone to outbursts. It was better to have him far away where this, you know, so there was less of a problem and things could be a little more controlled, because the police were a little easier to buy off in another country. That's the impression I got.
By the way, we do have scissors coming up, don't we? Yes.
Well, a razor.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. It was a razor. Yeah, because Marge visits and suspects Ripley, but then finds some of Dickie's rings in Ripley's apartment.
Right. Which involved the crazy scene with the candles going on the floor, which I expected a fire.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's a thing, you know. People used to have candles all the time.
Yeah, but there was a very specific cinematic focus on the candles hitting the floor. And so I was like, what? I mean, it's clearly some misdirection, I guess.
And also, by the way, who's Marge's friend? But Peter Smith Kingsley. And have you seen Peter Smith Kingsley? Or the actor's name is Jack Davenport.
I've seen him in other things.
Have you ever seen the BBC series, just like one season series, Ultraviolet?
No.
I would highly recommend it. It's a series. It's only 6 episodes long. It's about it's about vampires, but they never say the word vampire in the whole thing. And they do some things. I mean, I don't want to give it away. There are some angles they take that you would never do on American television. There's one in particular that I thought was really, really clever and creepy at the same time.
But I saw him in a series on ABC called Flash Forward. which was based on a novel, which I read, which is a great novel, by the way. The TV series is actually really quite good too, but of course, like all things ABC, they kind of started strong and then went crazy with it and then didn't opt to give it a second season because they were like, meh. I think had they allowed it to go to like a second and third season, it would have grown into a much bigger project, but ABC just didn't support it. That's what I remember him for. Is he was, I think he was a bad guy, but I can't remember. I haven't seen the show since it was on TV. But at any rate, but really like him as an actor. Really like his character in the movie.
I do too. He did a great job.
Yeah.
And then, Mr. Greenleaf hired the private detective, who's played by Philip Baker Hall, who is in everything. He's awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, he has 166 actor credits on IMDb. Okay, so at this point, actually, it's a kind of a complicated part of the story. We have, I believe it's still in Rome, where we have Marge and Peter, Jack Davenport, who know, of course, Ripley as Ripley. But then Kate Blanchett's character shows up, and she knows him, of course, as Dickie.
Right.
And, because she's never met Dickie, but she knows Freddie Miles, too. And she knows Marge. And when Ripley finds this out, it becomes very complicated.
Right.
So they have to do this thing where they break it to Marge that he tries to set everything in motion all at one place and does a fairly good job at it and just makes Marge go flipping crazy, which he can use that against her because she's just a woman.
Yes.
So clearly she's hysterical.
An hysterical, crazy, stupid woman.
Exactly. So because that's how women are.
At the one point where they're shooting the church scene where Peter is in the church and the little young boy is singing creepily, by the way. Do you remember this little boy? For some reason they were showing him as in his little priestly role playing music in the church, and then this little boy has like this solo singing piece that he does.
Okay.
But so you don't remember it, but
not
made an impression on me. I wrote down creepy boy singing with a voice that is clearly not his own. I was amused by that.
Did you see Dark Knight Rises?
No.
Oh, okay. Because there's a line from that movie that I always think of now when I hear kids in movies sing. Now we've basically got rid of Marge, and we've got rid of Mr. Greenleaf, and as luck would have it, Peter and Ripley have been attracted to one another ever since they first met.
Yes.
So now Ripley is going to finally find somebody who returns his affection and he could be a real boy again.
Yeah.
But then they go on a cruise together, he and Peter. And who else is on the cruise?
It was a damn celebrity cruise, probably.
Probably. Yeah. So who do we have is Meredith, Kate Blanchett's character, who knows him as Dickie. And I mean, obviously, Peter knows that he's not Dickie, and so that would be a very complicated situation for Peter and Meredith to meet each other.
Right.
So, as far as I'm concerned, you know, the killing Dickie and Freddy were pretty graphic and shocking.
Yeah.
But the end of this movie is brutal.
Well, because it's Hitchcocky and you don't see any of it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You don't see any of it, and it's, you know, he is distraught over it.
Yeah, no, and I don't know about you, but I really liked Peter as a character.
Oh yeah, he's the only guy in the movie that is you don't hate.
He's the only likable person, except that if you actually look at him in the context of the movie, he's a priest who's having sex with other dudes.
Well, okay, yeah, there's that.
So, I mean, I personally don't care, but I'm saying, you know, in the context of the movie and the writing, you have to wonder what the subtext there was, that because, in the 50s, priests weren't supposed to be doing any of that.
Well, I think they're still not supposed to be doing any of that, frankly.
Well, there's commentary about, but
yeah.
Regardless, I think the Peter character is the only character I really liked in the movie. I mean, who was really likable, who, like, you were interested in And I was like, oh, he's such a sweet guy, and you want him to be happy, and oh, he's going to make the, you know, he's going to make Ripley happy, and they might be happy. And I'm like, oh, no, he's going to kill him. Oh,
and he really likes Ripley. I mean, that's why the end is so brutal.
Terrible. And alone. And dark. And I've lied about who I am. And where I am. Now no one will ever find me.
What do you mean lied about who you are?
I always thought it'd be better to be a fake somebody than a real nobody.
What are you talking about? You're not a nobody, that's the last thing you are.
Peter. Tell me some good things about Tom Ripley.
No, don't get up. Don't get up. Don't get up. Just tell me some nice things about Tom Ripley.
Good things about Tom Ripley. Take me some time. Tom is talented. Tom is tender. Tom is beautiful.
You're such a liar.
Tom is a mystery. Tom is not a nobody. Secrets he doesn't want to tell me. And I wish he would. Tom has nightmares. That's not a good thing. Tom has someone to love him. That is a good thing. Tom is crushing me. Tom is crushing me. Tom, you're crushing me. Oh, God.
So it's like, oh, you dick. Like, kill yourself.
Yeah. So what'd you think of The Talented Mr. Ripley?
It was okay. I have a problem with movies like this because, as we have discussed, I quickly jump to the end of movies. And I didn't quite do that with this movie, but I have a hard time with movies that you know what's going to happen because you know the character's going to slip up because he's running too fast to keep himself from falling. And so movies like that give me this anxious kind of, like, I know what's going to happen. Why do you have to, you know, everybody sees what's going to happen except the characters. And I know it's a movie, but that's why I have a hard time. Same thing, hard time watching, like, TV sitcoms, because, you know, there's things that there's problems that are engineered simply to create tension so that you get to the resolution.
Yeah, and this movie was intended to make you anxious.
Yeah, well, and it worked, except that some of it was so obvious that I was like, oh, no.
Oh, we would be yelling at the screen if that were an option in our society.
Yeah, no, and so I wasn't quite yelling at the TV, but I was just, it made me anxious in a way that makes me not like the movie, as opposed to other movies that make me anxious, but in a way that I think is a supplement, a benefit of watching the movie. This, to me, the kind of the anxiousness I got, the anxiety I got, I guess is the correct term, was a detriment to watching the movie.
Yeah, the agita.
Because you just kind of knew, it was so clear what was going to happen that there was no tension. It was just there's just this anxiety over, like, you know what's going to happen.
Well,
like, you knew it was good.
Or, I mean, maybe from my point of view, what there wasn't, I mean, there was plenty of tension, but no release, because at the end, it was just so sad. Like, it did not end with any nice resolution.
Right. Well, it wasn't, yeah, it certainly wasn't an upbeat ending, but it was, a very non-American ending in a movie. You know, and I like that. I like that it wasn't like some, they lived happily ever after. Although, you know, I would have liked that. But again, I understand that, you know, it was just, he's a man just trying to protect himself and his, his assets, if you will.
Well, exactly. And where Ripley could be seen, I mean, you can totally see the character Ripley written by somebody else as a character like Zorro or even Batman or someone like that, where you have an alter ego, but you're doing it for the good, you know, or you have at least higher ideas in mind or a higher goal. Yeah, he's just basically killing these people so that he doesn't get found out. He is performing high stakes, high risk, high, you know, death count things for very low reward. I mean, I guess the money is important because now he has it and he didn't before. But he's not any happier. He doesn't seem to delight in the fact that he has accomplished all this.
Well, yeah, none of it brings him any real happiness except for and up to where he meets Peter and they have what ostensibly looks like a positive relationship.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. You think you're getting the happy ending. But then
yeah.
Elizabeth the First shows up. And you're like, oh, I hated you from the beginning of the movie. You rear your ugly head. Anyway.
Yeah. Maybe that's why I didn't like her. It's because she just, the bitch ruined everything.
Exactly. Through no real fault of her own. In fact, she was actually, no, she was a fairly pathetic character.
You know, she was maligned and.
Yeah. I mean, she really was sort of a pathetic character. She was as unsuave as Ripley was suave. Although maybe suave is the wrong word. Because he always kind of played it for, like he played, I don't know, how would you describe it? He charmed you by being kind of goofy and kind of self-deprecating.
He was kind of self-effacing and gregarious.
He didn't charm people so much as almost kind of get you feeling sorry for him.
He was very much kind of played the downtrodden little brother.
Yeah, little brother. There you go. So what do you think about The Talent of Mr. Ripley?
I really like it. The first time I watched it, not so much. Like, I didn't get it. I don't even remember if I saw it in the theater or not. If I didn't, it was right when it first came out on video. But my first go around with it was, that was not what I expected. But after watching it, I've seen it at least two more times, and it really grew on me. I mean, it's a strange, really dark movie. The subject matter is dark, but visually it's really light, so that's kind of jarring. It's really, really brightly set, and every performance in that movie is fantastic. Like, I don't think I knew who Jude Law was before that movie. I may not have known who Philip Seymour Hoffman was before that movie. I probably only knew Matt Damon from Good Will Hunting, maybe The Rainmaker. So that was quite a departure of what I expected from him. And it took me until the second viewing to really realize what was going on. You know, that Ripley was, in love with Dickie and coveted, the relationship that Dickie's girlfriend had with him.
Or you might argue he coveted even more the relationship Freddie had with him.
No, Freddie was like his buddy. I think he wanted to be more than buddies with Dickie.
Oh, definitely he wanted to be more than buddies.
Yeah.
What with the bathing situation?
Yes. Yeah, it's funny that never occurred to me the first go around through that movie. But maybe it's because I was so taken aback by how unexpected that movie was.
Well, I've got a question for you. Is Tom Ripley a sociopath?
No, I think he's a psychopath.
Okay. Yeah, interesting. I'll have to think, because they called him a sociopath in a couple of different places for plot summaries, and I don't think I believe that, because he definitely felt, he knew right from wrong, and he definitely felt bad for a lot of the things that he did.
Maybe. I think he felt remorse for having to do them more than he felt bad for what he did.
Okay. All right. Either way, I thought it was it's a beautiful movie. Absolutely beautiful. And the score was great. It's a very rich-looking movie.
And how great was Philip Seymour Hoffman?
Oh, the best.
I mean, every scene he was in, he stole.
Yeah.
And I don't even remember how much of the movie he was in, but not much.
But yeah, he pops in and out, but you're right. Every scene he was in, he stole.
How's the peepin'?
Yeah, exactly. Tom, have you ever heard of the game Gay or British?
No.
No, okay. Well, neither had Jason, actually. But I thought you could also play a similar game called Gay or Hoi Polloi New England. When you eventually watch some Spalding Gray stuff, you'll kind of see what I mean.
Yeah, that doesn't quite roll off the tongue the same way.
No, of course not. But still, that's because Jason was like, so was Dickie gay, or was his sexuality like fluid or whatever? I'm like, well, I don't think so.
I never thought Dickie was gay. I thought he had boundary issues.
Yeah, well, definitely. Yeah, and I guess the book may be different, although the author of the book is apparently was not a nice person.
No, I don't know anything about her.
Yeah, well, I read some from her, a clip from her biography, and an observation by an acquaintance of hers. And she's not seen in the best of lights. She didn't like people. She admitted she didn't like people.
Well, I don't like people.
Yeah, well, maybe to a less extent than she did. But, yeah. So, cool. Yeah, no, I liked the movie quite a bit. And the reason I suggested that Jason and I watch it was because I had just watched or listened to the book Disaster Artist. And Greg Sestero, who wrote the book, he ends up quoting the talent of Mr. Ripley a lot. It really spoke to him. So I thought, is there more to this movie than I remember? But
it's a pretty good movie.
Yeah, I thought it was a very good movie. Even with Gwyneth Paltrow.
Yeah, was that the last watchable thing she was in?
I'd have to think about it. I mean, she's actually plenty watchable. I don't like when she talks like as a person. She's a little out of touch, it seems, with the common person. But, you know, good for her. And she's a better actress than, say, Patricia Arquette.
Okay.
Well, we'll do. Anyway, further thoughts on Mr. Ripley?
It wasn't a horrible movie. I don't think I would watch it again. You know, I'm glad I saw it. It wasn't a horrible movie. I'd give it probably a 7 out of 10. So I'd give it a C.
Yeah. Said something very interesting. I'm interrupting you, I realize. But you said something very interesting because I think I texted you about something else just before you started the movie.
Yeah.
Or as you were starting it. And you sent a text that said, oh my God, a Miramax film.
Yeah.
What did you mean by that?
So, when I worked at the movie theater in 89, Miramax Studios.
The Weinsteins.
No, what's that?
The Weinsteins.
Is that who owned Miramax?
I'm pretty sure, yeah.
Well, they had a history, at least unofficially, in the movie world, in the movie theater world, of producing and distributing movies that were not mainstream movies and offbeat movies, clearly, and not always the best movies, just kind of B-grade movies. And The most memorable of which happened because it was the first, I think, the first not rated movie that our theater experienced, which we got picketed for, of course, because the certain sect of the People's Republic of Jerry Prevost, Baptist Temple picketed because they had some problem with it, which was the Miramax film, The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover.
Which, by the way, I have never seen that movie, but do you think it would hold up?
The movie didn't hold up when it was made.
Yeah, I mean, it had some shocking scenes, right? But was it even considered a good movie? I mean, Helen Mirren, right?
Was it Helen Mirren?
I think it was Helen Mirren.
It might have been. Let me look it up now. Yeah, no, it was Helen Mirren. Tim Roth. Oh, how did I forget that? I don't know. I did not. I didn't think it was a good movie.
Well, you guys had to basically. It was the first time. It was like what, the first NC-17 movie?
Yeah, I think that's what it was.
And so you guys had to actually like enforce the ratings for the first time.
Yeah, and it was a big problem, and it. In the days of movie, there's a lot of inside baseball stuff. In those days, as a movie theater, you bid to get films. So as a movie theater entity, we would bid to the studios and we would say, we want this movie and we're going to pay you X number of dollars to rent the film from you so that we can play it at our theater. And then that's what your box office ticket pays for, by the way. You pay for the rental of the film, the physical movie. And then all the concession stand stuff pays for everything else, the building and the light and the heat and the popcorn and payroll and all that. But going into it, I think the boss knew that it was not going to be a big seller because it opened the opening day. It was in our smallest theater.
Well, it was the movie hardest to get into.
Well, that's true, but even so, like, normally even in a movie that's hard to get into, we wouldn't have opened it in the smallest theater. We would have put it in one of the middle theaters as opposed to the two largest, but anyway, but that kind of told me what kind of movie it was, but then seeing it was like, yeah, no, not the greatest movie. It's okay, but no, I don't think it would hold up if you watched it today. I don't have a good thing to say because I don't, you know, now it's been so long. I'm like, I only remember bits and pieces of it, and the bits and pieces I remember were the bad parts. So,
well, yeah, and that's, I mean, again, if I cared enough to watch it in the first place, it might be worth talking about whether you could cut it in a way that we wouldn't be NC-17. On the other hand, I don't really care. It's not.
Well, I don't see, and the reason, and I mean,
to me, it seemed like a bunch of pretentious art house crap that they did on purpose to get that
N-17. But the reason that it got the NC-17 rating is because she, I don't know, you want the spoiler?
Spoiler alert.
But, you know, the end of the movie, she basically, like, cooks the dude and cuts off and eats his penis.
Yeah, well, there we go.
So that was pretty much why I think the movie got the rating that did, because the MPAA has this thing for male nudity in any form that you can't show penis or it's automatically bad. But, you know, you'll show boobs and vagina all they want.
And violence. Violence, violence, violence.
Well, there's that too. So now I'm reading the MPAA controversy.
Well,
refused an R rating due to the level of sex and violence, and thus left distributors Miramax with two choices, to release it as an X or as unrated. An X would have been the death knell. It would have gone nowhere if it were an X.
Oh yeah, because it's not sexy enough to be an X-rated movie.
Well, and we couldn't have played it in the theater.
That's true. Yeah, that's true.
We would have never, it would never, the chain would have never, ever allowed it. Which is, I think, why it ended up NC-17. But even that, it was just a ridiculous movie. I thought it was a ridiculous movie.
Well, and it became clear that the chains weren't interested in NC-17 movies after that either.
Well, because it's hard to fill a theater.
Yeah, exactly.
17. And it turns parents off, which is funny because in our rating, it's not the death knell either. But our rating, parents are much less apt to deny their children to see an R movie. Most parents are going to not ever take their children to see an NC-17 movie.
Oh,
they would have to take the child.
Yeah. Well, and so, did you see the movie, the documentary, This Film Is Not Yet Rated?
No.
I highly recommend it. Highly. Because it talks about what the MPAA is and what kind of... Well, at first it was just what you kind of had to do to try to get your movie, to be down to whatever level you wanted it to be.
Yeah.
And then it became a game. Like, that's where you get a lot of DVD extras on, say, comedies and stuff. Because people like, Trey Parker.
That's what they cut to get into the right rating.
Well, yeah, Trey Parker and Matt Stone, if they gave you Team America World Police and gave you the big sex scene between the marionettes, they'd be like, no, you can't do that. That's why they threw in stuff like they had the marionettes during sex pooping on each other. I mean, they had all these things they put way over the top because that way they can say, okay, you need to cut this and this and this, and then they slid all the rest of the stuff in there.
Right. It was, which, by the way, I own the DVD with the extended poop scene.
Yeah, and it's just, it's funny that they had to do that, but it's also realized that, and of course, the movie gets into what the MPAA really is and how it really is subjective completely.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. No, it's been that way forever. I mean, we knew as a movie theater that the rating was, Because we would tell people, people would ask us opinions on movies, and they'd be like, is it really PG? Is it really R? We'd be like, no, not really. It's only PG because you keep shooting people, but other than that, it's not that bad a film.
Well, and now you have to throw swear words into a movie so it doesn't get a G rating.
Right, because you don't want that.
No, because then no one will go see your G rated movie either. That's not a cartoon. So,
correct.
Yeah. So it's interesting. It's interesting the world in which we live.
So to bring it all back, there was a while there for many years, if it started in a Miramax logo, it just wasn't going to be that good a movie.
You just groaned from the beginning?
Yeah. And which is why when I saw that pop up, I was like, oh no. But this movie was made, ostensibly closer, much later in the 90s. So,
well, and the Weinsteins, they control a lot of what gets made, or they have a lot of influence, let's say. And they've got a lot of connections, too, which makes it, when they decide to take a chance, that's a good thing. But if for some reason you turn them off, that's a bad thing as an artist. So,
yeah.
I mean, with great power becomes great responsibility, or all power corrupts, something or other. Plus, it's a way you can say that the Jews control Hollywood. Because these two Jewish brothers.
Yeah.
I mean, ask Mel Gibson, he'll tell you.
Yeesh. I'm trying to see if there's a list of Miramax films, just a comprehensive list of Miramax films. Oh, yeah, there's a whole list of them here. On IMDb, of course. I'm trying to think if there's anything in here that just jumps out as indicative of exactly of...
of what we're talking about?
Yeah. Nothing really. No Country for Old Men. That was a Miramax.
Yeah.
We go back though, because I think once they hit 2000, I think that they tightened it down a little bit.
Production companies really do. Studios really do live and die with certain trends. Like one bad movie can sink your company. You have to be careful. And then also, of course, one crazy runaway hit, like the Nightmare on Elm Street series, can make your company into a serious contender for a studio.
I'm going back to, 94. Oh, they did The Crow.
Yeah, that movie does not hold up.
No.
And the fact that somebody died making that movie makes me sad.
Hellraiser 3, they did The Crying Game.
Oh, you know what? Hellraiser 3 is my favorite Hellraiser movie. And The Crying Game was a great movie, and it was big.
Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah, there you go.
Kafka. The Pope Must Diet. Oh, that was a terrible movie.
The Pope Must Diet?
Yes.
Who is in that? Like Guido Sarducci film?
I think you haven't seen it.
No, I have not seen it.
It's a great movie. Robbie Coltrane plays the Pope.
Okay.
You don't know. No. You don't have any idea.
No, I have no idea.
Okay. So when you're done, go look at the trailer for The Pope Must Die. It is a horrible, terrible, great. It's a comedy. But Robbie Coltrane, who played, I think he played a detective on. I think I watched him as the detective on the BBC series. Been in a ton of stuff. He played Cracker. But I'm trying to think. He had some...
He played Cracker? He played the main character in Cracker?
I think he was...
Because I've got his... TV, yeah, I've got his TV face series. Then if that's the guy...
He was Dr. Eddie Fitzgerald.
Okay.
In the Cracker TV series.
Okay.
He was GoldenEye. He was in GoldenEye. That's where I know him from as well. He's been in a ton of stuff.
If the podcast tonight sounds a little stilted, we blame it on VOIP. VOIP, what you get if you don't want a real phone. VOIP.
So it's just like at the 25-minute mark, I've noticed now. At 25 minutes, it just goes, nope.
That's funny.
I have to call Comcast back.
Comcast is your nanny.
Probably.
Now, young lady, no talking to your friends late at night on that phone.
Well, no, it's like, you know, can't run up the charges, 25 minutes and you're done. Anyway, Robbie Coltrane plays the Pope. It's a great movie. It was just funny because I haven't thought of him in some time. But anyway, digress. To babble more, Miramax, it was synonymous with kind of bad B-grade, not going to be good movies. Although, in looking at the list now, I don't know why I thought that, because, you know, they made some good movies. What was that? Hardware, was that?
Oh, yeah. That I love that movie.
Oh,
at least at the time I did. It was so stylish. Yeah, it just had such its own feel to it.
Dylan McDermott.
Oh, yeah.
Who was the studio behind that?
No, it was great. It was Simon Boswell did the score to it, and Iggy Pop was a character, and they had Ministry did, like, my favorite Ministry song, although they showed it as a music video in the movie, and Ministry is doing the song, but Gore is doing the band. So it gave me the wrong idea of what Ministry was about.
It was playing at the movie theater when I worked there, and I just remember I loathed it as a movie. I loathed it.
Oh, I love it. It's horrible. I love it. What is it? In fact, I took a bunch of quotes from the Hardware soundtrack and was going to incorporate them into the podcast until I realized that was not the great thing to do copyright wise. Although I think I might drop It's Horrible, I Love It, What Is It in here.
There's parts of movies that I've seen thousands of times because of working at the movie theater, which I know have spoiled me on some movies forever.
It's a science fiction movie. You like that.
But I didn't like the type. It was violent. It was a violent movie.
It was violent. It was sort of a post-apocalyptic. It was, let's say, Iron Giant meets Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
And I love, like, post-apocalyptic movies, but this was very violent, and I'm bad with violent things, because...
This is Short Circuit meets The Road.
the best synopsis ever.
It's true, though.
Number five is alive.
Yeah.
But oh my god, I thought The Road was a great novel and a great movie, by the way.
Okay, I'm going to disagree with you on both counts.
I don't know. It was very. I mean,
it was very atmospheric, also, but just in a way I found super impressive. Like, I wanted to escape The Road. That was the problem. I felt trapped in The Road, both the novel and the movie.
Well, we were supposed to.
Well, it did its job then.
I mean, it was a sad story about a father and son.
That it was.
So, I mean, you know.
And also Robin Wright Penn, right?
Robin Wright Penn?
Yeah, wasn't she the mom? Or wasn't that Naomi Watts?
Who was the mom? Robin Wright Penn?
Now I know how I need to know who the mom was. It must be Naomi Watts.
I don't remember because I didn't. I mean, because you don't like her. You're not supposed to like her. And in fact, you just root for her death anyway.
Okay.
Charlize Theron.
Oh, Charlize Theron. Okay. There you go.
But Viggo Mortensen, what a great job.
Oh, yeah, no, Viggo Mortensen is great. I would prefer to watch Eastern Promises or The History of Violence if I want to see Viggo. You can keep your Lord of the Rings. You can keep your Road.
By the way, Hardware, distributed in the U.S. by Miramax.
Oh, yeah. No. Let me tell you, that's on my list of movies to do.
Well, you and Drew will have a great time.
Yeah, well, we'll see. I'm not even sure he's on board for that one. And there are
like
a couple
Robin
movies.
Hood, that Robin Hood abomination of a movie starring Kevin Costner was another movie I've seen parts of 1,000,000,000,000,000 times that I just want to drive a spike into Kevin Costner's skull.
I think you're being too harsh on Mr. Costner, but...
And I like some Costner movies. Dances with Wolves is a beautiful, great movie. You know, and I'm not opposed to Kevin Costner. You know, JFK is a great movie.
Yeah, we're going to have to do JFK because that is a fantastic movie.
Bull Durham, a great movie. Waterworld, not a great movie.
No. Yeah, absolutely. Not at all.
Field of Dreams, great movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Madonna. What was the Madonna movie called?
I'm not sure. You're going to have to narrow that one down.
No, what was it called? There was some name to it, Madonna. But all I can think of is Madonna, Dead and Loving It. That's not it.
Are you talking about the actual reality movie?
Yeah, the documentary.
Truth or Dare,
there you go. Okay.
A movie that I think Terry and I drugged you to.
Yeah, that's how I was introduced to Madonna and Terry.
Oh. Well, Truth or Dare is a great movie.
Yeah, it's also a Kevin Costner movie.
Well, but he's not in it.
He's
acting badly.
No, he's just being Kevin Costner.
Right, and I don't have any problem with that. I have a problem with him having an American accent when everybody else is speaking with a British accent.
Okay.
Go the distance.
Yeah, well, we are...
Like, he's the American Sean Connery.
Well, one of the criticisms I had about The Frozen Ground, and I won't ruin it for you at all, is that I think Nicolas Cage actually does a really good job, but he, unlike John Cusack, he is not a good voice actor. He does not change his voice for different roles that he plays that I can notice.
Nicolas Cage?
Yeah.
Yeah, no.
So, you know.
He's kind of a one note actor.
Yeah, I mean, Kevin Costner, he may just be incapable of it like Nicolas Cage. No, actually, I think Nicolas Cage is really talented. It's just he can't do the subtle voice. Like, John Cusack transforms a little bit for the role. I don't see Nick Cage transforming for the role. I see him reading his lines very well.
I would agree with that. Okay, so I think we've beat this to death now.
Yeah, so are we going to do Victor Victoria next time?
We may have to postpone that because I don't have a copy of that and I don't know where it's available.
Yeah, and I don't either,
I think we definitely need to do it as some kind of, you know, James Garner tribute, clearly. We don't, you know, I'm not in a rush to do it like next week.
Yeah, that's fine.
So.
What else would you like to do?
What else did we say we were going to do? Because there was a couple movies.
There's
Capote, right?
Capote is definitely on that. We can do Capote. We can even do, of course, now I can't think of the stupid Capote movie. You know, the actual movie.
In Cold Blood?
In Cold Blood, yeah. We can do that, too. I have a copy of that.
Is In Cold Blood available?
I don't know. I mean, I have a copy of it because I bought it in the same double pack as Capote. But actually, I think Capote's the better movie. But yeah, we can pick anything. I mean, just we don't even have to. This your choice. The sky is the limit. I think I've picked the last couple ones. So, you know, there's other James Garner movies. I haven't seen Hail to the Chief. Isn't that one?
Robert Blake.
Yeah, wow. Robert Blake was in In Cold Blood. Yeah, it's a movie we're seeing.
Wow.
And it has an Alaska connection to it, too.
Huh.
Because I think Perry Smith's dad had, like, a homestead or something around Indian.
I've got Capote, so we can do that, certainly.
Yeah, I'm up for it, if you are.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to spoil it because I have a story about watching it.
Excellent. So. Okay. Perfect. That gives us something to look forward to for next week. Send your feedback to show@notinthecreepyway.com or call us on a new voicemail account to leave voice messages. Or you can text us at this account to leave text messages. The number is 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. What are you waiting for? Put it in your phone right now, and then when you listen to an episode, you can just hit your contacts, dial it already.